This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in August of 2018.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For much of the past 2 years, award-winning journalist Earl Swift lived and reported on a tiny island in Virginia. The resulting book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island, is an elegiac portrait of this isolated community, a sweeping natural history of an extraordinary ecosystem, and a timely meditation on dire environmental realities that extend far beyond the shores of Tangier, which seems likely to succumb first among U.S. towns to the effects of climate change. Earl Swift has written 6 previous books, including Autobiography, The Big Roads, which is New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, and Where They Lay, a Penn finalist. And he's written about Chesapeake region for 30 years. He's circumnavigated the bay by kayak. And since 2012, Earl Swift has been a residential fellow for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities at the University of Virginia. Earl Swift, welcome to the program.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
So how did you, I guess you've reported on the Chesapeake area, so you would have been familiar with Tangier Island. How did you come to want to do this reporting on the island and the resulting book?
Well, if you live along the banks of the Chesapeake, and I did for 22 years in Norfolk, you come to understand that Tangier's an almost mystical place. It's swathed in stories that seem impossible, especially in the early 21st century, that, you know, a place so isolated, though only 100 miles from Washington, D.C., so isolated that it's developed its own style of speech, which to an untuned mainland ear is utterly indecipherable. The fact that these 460 odd islanders are all descended from the same family of settlers who put down there in 1778. It just seems so anachronistic, such a throwback, that the notion that it could have survived the centuries relatively intact seems a stretch. And yet, when I finally got around to going to Tangier in 1999, I found just that. I found a town on a squiggle of marsh and mud, 12 miles from the nearest mainland port, surrounded by 18 trillion gallons of often tempestuous water, in which community actually means something. It means far more than it's come to mean in most of the rest of the world. I think this is a place where everybody truly has his or her neighbor's back, to the extent that they would die for each other. And I saw that demonstrated. Luckily, you don't see it demonstrated often, but it played out before my eyes in the spring of 2017. Hmm. So, you know, once I'd had a little taste of the place, I found myself wanting to go back again and again and again. My first visit was in 1999 for a newspaper profile. I returned late that year to spend Y2K on the island, and in that it is a old-school Christian and a dry island, that was about the quietest millennial celebration on the planet, I think, was further wedded to go back. And did so in the spring of 2000, spent 6 weeks on and off the island on that occasion with a photographer. And our purpose there was to write a package of stories for the Norfolk newspaper, the Virginian Pilot, that explored the existential challenge that faced the island, namely that it had lost two-thirds of its land mass since 1850. And that with the bay on the rise and the island itself, like much of the lower Chesapeake, sinking, the prognosis for its survival was pretty bleak.
Yeah, subtitled Vanishing Tangier Island. You open the book, in fact, with a trip that one of the residents, Carol Moore, took out to, I guess, a part of the island that, a community that's no longer there because that land is now submerged or is submerging.
That's right. Tangier is it's extremely low-lying. It's bored flat. The highest point on the island is 5 feet. Very few parts of the island top 3 feet above the tides, and most of it, being salt marsh, fails to clear 1 foot. And so when the tide is high, the water floods the entire interior of the place. When you have a particularly high tide, it leaps the banks of the marsh and covers the roads and comes into yards and really makes islands of the houses. So this is a place that's been pretty amphibious for a long time. But what Carol Moore found in the opening of the book, which takes place in 2016, a day after Hurricane Sandy had passed by to the east, was the remains of an old graveyard that had been stirred up by the storm, a graveyard that at one point had been hundreds of feet from the water's edge, but which the bay had gradually encroached on until it consumed it. And so the book opens with Carol making this awful discovery, made all the more so by the fact that the graves that were unearthed in that episode belonged to her direct forebears.
And then you, the introduction, you go out and you encounter some, gravestones out there. It's got to be very poignant, especially for
it is. It's sobering. You're seeing the island's past and its future at the same time when you stand at that former settlement is called Canaan, and it's on a part of the island that's today uninhabited, but at one point was studded with little enclaves of houses. And those settlements have been abandoned one after the other, most in the early 20th century, because the water just kept coming. And it's been sneaky on sea level rise on Tangier. It most often takes the form of wind-driven waves coming in from the west and just pounding the island from that side. With that, the island has withered most dramatically on that side. But it's also chipped away at the other parts of the shoreline and just stealing a little bit away at a time. But you lose a half inch of this peaty sod that the island consists of per day, and you've lost a foot a month. And so it has clawed its way through not only Canaan, but now threatens Tangier proper, where the island's 460 current residents live.
You also write, you point out that there have been other islands in Chesapeake that have disappeared. You talk about Sharp's Island, Holland Island, much earlier, last century, but where settlers had to abandon those islands.
They did. And the Chesapeake is always... it's always had waves, and Tangier sticks is the farthest flung of all of them. It's smack in the middle of the widest part of the bay. It's about 30 miles wide there. And most of the other inhabited islands, including those that you mentioned, were further north and actually pretty protected. But even so, they were open to wind-driven waves, and especially waves from the west side, where you have a lot of open water, a lot of room for winds to build wave action up, a lot of what mariners call fetch. And in the case of Holland Island, Holland was a completely stable place through the Civil War. And then there have been a number of scientific studies that have shown that beginning right about 1850, right at the midpoint of the 19th century, something started to change in the Chesapeake Bay. And it may be instructive for what was going on with water elsewhere as well. But what you see is a point of inflection where suddenly land loss starts to accelerate. What had been very steady on Holland became a pretty critical erosion on that island's west side that forced the abandonment of a line of houses there. And with that abandonment, Holland's economy imploded, and everybody moved off. And it took long enough to get bad that it really wasn't until right at the turn of the 20th century that Holland Islanders recognized, holy smokes, we've got a real issue here. There were 231 of them on the island, I think, at that point. There were 160 160, 170 of them still living there shortly before World War One, and by 1920, every one of them had gone.
What's the prognosis for Tangier Island? How soon could the water, or when do we think the water might swallow up the island?
Well, that's a point of contention. In 2015, a scientific journal called Scientific Reports published a study that was put together by three researchers associated with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Norfolk District of the Corps, which oversees that part of the Chesapeake. And they had used mapping technology to take charts of the bay dating back to 1850 and overlaying them essentially to chart the rate of erosion, of land loss over time, and then to extrapolate what we could expect to see happen in the coming years. And the view was not in the least encouraging. In the report, they used a kind of a middle model for sea level rise to come up with the prognosis that the town would most likely have to be abandoned in 50 years or less, and that the island would be gone, would disappear completely within 100. Since then, the authors of that report have acknowledged that middle case scenario for sea level rise in the bay was probably overly conservative, and they should have used a worst case scenario model, which would see Tangier most likely abandoned in 25 years or less. And even that is, in some views, in the views of some, an optimistic forecast.
I want to read, this is from a review by Jonathan Miles, of a positive review of your book. He says, at this point, we're no longer shocked by such forecasts, talking about, forecasts of Tangier's 25 years or whatever it's going to be. Having absorbed louder, larger-scale predictions that owing to sea level rise, places such as Miami and New Orleans may one day be reefs rather than cities. He goes on to say, likewise for Tangier's several hundred residents, with one major exception, they don't need to imagine it. They're watching it happen. Leads me to my next question, which is what do the residents of Tangier think? What are they saying?
Well, it's important to remember that this is a virtually amphibious people who have made their living from the bay since the very beginning of the 19th century. And they know the water well. And most of their knowledge of the water, their expertise of it, is based on anecdotal learning, what they see and experience on the water every day. Tangier is home to a fleet of shallow draft, mostly wooden boats that its men take out onto the bay every day to fish up the justly famed Chesapeake Bay blue crab. And Tangier lays claim to being the soft shell crab capital of the world, and has earned every bit of that. So these people know their water, and they have found themselves at odds with scientists often over the years. Throughout the 80s and 90s, it was over the health of the blue crab as a species. The government and universities were worried that the crab was being overfished, the Tangierman and other crabbers were eating their seed corn, essentially. Tangierman disagreed strenuously with that assessment. So they have an innate distrust of science, of book learning in general. There's no question that they can recognize that something terrible is unfolding around them, that a slow-motion natural disaster is underway at Tangier. They see the water coming up out of the marsh. They know that high tides that in the past had no effect on the town itself now not only chip away, come up over the edges of the island, but bubble up straight out of the ground to make ponds in their yards. And what they differ with the scientific mainstream on is that man has had any hand in what's happening. I don't think that their views are often mischaracterized as they don't believe in sea level rise. Well, no, that's not exactly true. They recognize that something's going on, but they, being deeply religious, staunchly conservative in their politics, tend to believe that that this is part of nature's cycles, that that this is a God-ordained part of the planet's rhythms, and that man has no hand in what's going on.
And so they're not so much interested in a debate about climate change, but I think they do want action, right? And they're it seems like, and I went from your website, earlswift.com, I went to a CNN report in which you appear and the mayor of the town appears, and he and some other fellows sitting around. By the way, the town voted overwhelmingly for President Trump, and they're looking for some action from him, I believe.
They've been looking for action for quite some time, Tom. Because they see the problem is mostly one of erosion rather than an inexorable rise of the bay. They see that the problem is simple and the solution is pretty simple, and that is you build a wall around the island, and if necessary, you blow in dredge fill to raise the level of its land, and voila, you've protected it for centuries to come. Needless to say, that's received a tepid response from the outside world, mostly because you've only got 460 people living on the island directly benefiting from what would be just an heroic expense of public dollars and effort. But with Donald Trump's ascension to the presidency, I think they see hope that that he will take action, and that has not been borne out yet. I guess we'll have to wait to see if it is. But as you indicate, they voted 87% plus for Donald Trump in 2016. This is Trump Island.
The mayor is quite a guy. He features prominently in your book. He says he views Trump as like a family member. He goes on to say, along with another couple of guys there, he says, they talk about a wall. We'll take a wall.
Yeah, which got a laugh. I was sitting next to Uecker, James Uecker Eskridge, the mayor, when he said that to CNN. I was just off camera. And even by the typically strident measures of politics on Tangier, when he announced that he loved Donald Trump as much as any family member he had, I have to say I was Google-eyed. They want to see a wall, this is such a long shot in terms of even feasibility that I don't want to give it, too much time. But the Corps of Engineers has looked or is looking into the possibility of perhaps preserving Tangier, not for its human residents, but for wildlife, especially migratory waterfowl that need offshore marshland along the Atlantic Flyway. And that kind of habitat is fast disappearing and of great value. Of such great value that the island is worth far more as habitat than it is as, for the infrastructure of the town. And so the Corps is nosing around with a scheme that would see it restore Tangier as essentially a wildlife refuge. And if that were to happen, well, then the town might be saved along with it. But the timeline for such a thing is such that it's a real question as to whether, even if they went ahead with it at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, whether there would be anyone left on Tangier to celebrate by the time it was finished.
You point out that the decisions we're making now about places like Tangier might set direction, might have an effect on the bigger decisions that will be coming down the road. And you say, I wonder if you could expand on this, that perhaps we shouldn't make the criterion, the headcount. Because if that's the case, then, you know, 570 people, no brainer, we don't save this island. But there are other things to consider.
Yeah, well, I mean, Tangier is an inconvenient first case. We have to decide how to decide what we save and what we surrender to the sea, because we lack the time, the money, and the technical means to save every place that is going to be imperiled along America's 88,000-mile shoreline. And, you know, Tangier is a tiny town, and at first glance would seem a pretty easy candidate for abandonment, except that if you are going to use headcount as your sole criterion, you are then, you're going to surrender a lot of places that might not be big, but are essentially sacred ground in the American experience. So it can't be that simple. What we have to do as a country, as a people, is come up with a rubric for how, you know, what we value, what's important to us, and decide according to that rubric. You know, on that kind of measure, a place like Tangier, which is an outlier culturally, linguistically, in just about every way you can be, might be worth a look, you know, to saving, because this is a town that is truly like no other in the United States. And when we lose a place like Tangier, we lose some of the spice that in the American dish. It is not by any means a mainstream community that reflects the typical American experience, but that is what might be its value.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about that, the culture, the history, the unique spices that make up Tangier Island. We're talking with Earl Swift, author most recently of Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. More following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're back with Earl Swift. His latest book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. You know, some predictions give the island maybe 25 years at the current rate of erosion, and then it perhaps slips into the Chesapeake Bay. We want to talk a bit about culture and history. This is a very unique place. And we'll get into talking about this segment of the program. So Earl Swift, you went. I mean, you had various visits, but you went and spent a year, I guess, more or less straight with people of Tangier.
14 months, beginning in May of 2016. That's when I took up residence.
Yeah,
I rented the second floor of a house on one of the three parallel ridges of dry ground that rise out of the marsh on Tangier proper. And to call them ridges stretches the definition of the term, because if you were to stand in the marsh and look around you, you'd be hard-pressed to figure out what was dry ground and what was wet. They are imperceptibly higher than the surrounding wetlands.
Hmm. And you described the, especially the fishermen, the men, as amphibious.
Well, the entire population is, but particularly the men. I mean, this is a place that was mapped by John Smith in 1608, settled in 1778 by a gentleman named Joseph Crockett. And virtually every island-born Tangierman today can trace his or her lineage back to Joseph Crockett. This is an island of cousins and closer, one big extended family. So there's that sets it apart, that quirk. And, you know, they've been isolated for so long that they have developed this pattern of speech that is a mixture of the Tidewater hoitoid accent and a Cornish lilt, vaguely Irish in its sound, strangely rhythmed strangely. The cadences are different from what we're accustomed to. Single syllable words are knotted into two and three syllables. And to complicate things further, Tangiermen often say exactly the opposite of what they mean. So if you can make out the words, you still may completely misunderstand what you're hearing.
It's a
place that has no doctor, no live-in doctor. The nearest emergency room is 30 miles away by helicopter, assuming that the weather is fit to fly. They are out on the edge, dependent on each other and on few others, and consequently, this is a hardy people who have grown accustomed to seeing the water as a tool, and so yes, they are amphibious. What we would see as a terrible disadvantage, you know, this giant moat of water separating us from the rest of the planet. They have come to deal with pretty comfortably.
Let's hear. I went to YouTube, and I just pulled up about a minute and a half of Tangierman speaking. This is from an episode of something called American Tongues. This is episode 3, and I just pulled a portion of this. So you'll hear some people on Tangier Island speaking. You'll hear the accent and the dialect. Some of this I could understand. Others of this I could not. And maybe that'll be the case with our listeners. So here's just a little bit of this.
Guy Aiken Hyam and your Saturday night. Right. They drove his mom out. I had to get out, Hyam. His mom's been calling and cussing at me all day. She was behind the counter. She said, "It's a lie, Jack." I said, "Who's that, mom?"
First permanent settlement, white settlement on the island, was in 1686. There have been people living here ever since. Nearly about all of us that were born here on this island, we can say that our parents were born here, and our grandparents, and our great-grandparents, and our great-great-grandparents, and right on down.
What amazes me is that I can be most anywhere. I can be in the mall in Salisbury, Maryland, for example, and I can hear Tangierman talking in the crowd, and I can immediately tell, hey, they're from home, you know.
It used to be like Claude and them said, you could follow the crabs right on down. Now they don't do that no more. I think they get on top of the water and swim when they get ready to live. Swim over top of the pots instead of in them.
Eagle Paws, sir, where they're at.
Where is they at?
Just outside of the mud, the Eagle Paws, sir. They ain't cutting that off either, that crowd going out.
No. If we're talking among ourselves, we might fall in to the pattern of years ago and use words that you're not used to, that you haven't heard.
You're gonna have to move the boss.
But it's just about gone now. We talk like everybody else. I figure I sound just like Walter Cronkite.
So he says just like Walter Cronkite. Some great people there. The first part of that when they slipped into the deep, the dialect. I didn't really understand much.
See, that's the issue is when they're talking to each other, you're lost until you've been there for a while and you can tune your ear to it. When they're talking to a visitor, they'll make an effort to be understood. They'll dial it down, but it's I guess with any language group when you're with friends, you know, you get lazier in your constructions and the Tangier speak is uses a lot of shorthand and as I mentioned, it's often flipped. It's talking backwards. So for instance, if an attractive woman walked by a group of watermen, invariably one would say, "She ain't nothing to look at." You know, of course, I'm saying it in more or less proper English compared to what they'd say, but that would be the, and everyone in the group would understand that that's not what that speaker meant.
I was interested in the comments. I'm not sure if it was to this clip on YouTube or another one. Someone from the UK was listening to that, and they said that reminded them of the way people in Sussex used to speak, but only the very old people in Sussex speak that way anymore because everything's been evened out and people speak, you know, more or less proper London dialect nowadays. I guess it's an isolation factor.
Cornwall.
Cornwall is where it is. Okay.
Yeah, that's that. that's what's most often cited as the source for the Tangier accent. Is,
yeah.
Settlers, 19th century settlers from Cornwall.
And I guess the isolation would be a big factor in preserving
and,
this.
And that's, of course, becoming less the case now that satellite TV has arrived on the island and the internet and whatnot. But for 150 years, they were just talking to each other. And I guess it was self-reinforcing.
Mm. The one gentleman in the clip you heard there, he seemed very, you could see you couldn't see his face in this sound clip, but he seemed very proud that you know, his father was born on the island, the grandfather, great-grandfather. He could trace his lineage right on back. Everybody was born right there on the island.
Yeah. Well, like I said, they all know who the wellspring of this particular genetic line is, and it's Joseph Crockett. Kids on the island, I guess, are 10th generation now. Adults in their 50s and 60s are 8th or 9th, and they all can pretty much take you back one generation after the next to a degree that most Americans cannot.
Tell me a little bit more about the culture, the customs. Anything stand out to you?
Well, it is maybe a little less so than in the past, but Tangier is a functioning theocracy, basically, of old-school Methodists and a breakaway flock of even more old-school biblical literalists. It's dry, as I mentioned. In the 1990s, in fact, Tangier's town council voted to not allow a Kevin Costner movie, Message in a Bottle, to film there because of scenes of beer drinking and PG-13 sex in the script. And, you know, that's pretty typical. Until recently, there were no Harry Potter novels in the school library. It's a place where, with very old-fashioned sensibilities about what's right and what's wrong. Which is part of its charm and part of the challenge of living there as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there, I understand, no cell service, or at least until recently maybe? I don't know.
No, it dies about halfway across when you're on the mail boat headed for the island. And very occasionally there will be some sort of atmospheric glitch that will let you get a signal for a minute or two, but it dies as quickly as it comes. And so no, there's no cell service. Everybody uses a landline, and they have a communication system, a phone tree basically on the island that can move news over the ridges with lightning speed. It's an incredibly efficient method of communication. So if, for instance, the siren on top of the firehouse goes off, within 2 minutes, everyone on the island knows who's sick or who's been hurt, whether a helicopter is coming in for them, you know, what the state of the individual is. I mean, all the details have been passed along. It's remarkable.
Hmm. I guess that it's that community, which for some people would be too closed in, but if you like the community, that's a virtue of it.
It is. If you have kids, you can let your kids roam without fear. Pretty much, they have an entire village watching over them. And if you are a kid, it's a natural wonderland. You can mudlark in the marsh and go crabbing, go fishing. There's a mile-long, beautiful white sand beach that very few Tangiermen walk. It's virtually empty all the time. And the island being a busy place during the day. Most people don't have time for that sort of thing.
Hmm.
It's but those pluses are also balanced out by a couple of natural challenges. One of them being that on a summer day when the wind isn't blowing, the island is populated by voracious mosquitoes and green-eyed deer flies that will carve a bloody crater out of your skin and defy you to slap them while they're doing it. No, they'll keep biting right up until your hand flattens them. And to be besieged by greenheads, is as the flies are called there, is an experience that you remember.
I wonder. Would you consider relocating there?
Well, it's not the best real estate investment at the moment, Tom. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
It's a disappearing island.
It's a disappearing island, right? I guess you'd get to 20 some odd years in.
Yeah. So you borrow the view for a while, and that is one of the terrible challenges facing the place. I think there are probably some islanders who would quit Tangier if it weren't for the fact that they can't afford to. They're pretty much locked into homes that they cannot sell, or cannot sell for a price that would enable them to buy another home on the mainland. Smith Island, which is a Maryland island across the state line to the north, in much more protected water, a much shorter distance to Crisfield, Maryland, the nearest mainland port, has been able to attract weekenders from Baltimore and elsewhere who have bought some of the old houses. Tangier, way out in the middle of the bay, a much dicier place to reach, has not had that experience, and so 60-some-odd houses sit empty now. Not that you would know that. They're all very well kept. The entire town is pretty well maintained. But still, there's a lot of empty housing stock as the population's dropping. You know, there are two forms of erosion at work on Tangier right now, the physical and the demographic.
I was going to ask you, are people staying? I guess some people would leave, but they can't, economic reasons. Are the young people staying?
Well, it used to be that until the early 80s, say, virtually every Tangier boy dropped out of school in the 9th or 10th grade and went to follow his father onto the water. And at the time, you could buy a fully rigged boat for $25,000 or less, and a bank would lend you every penny of that. Now that same boat costs you $150,000, and the bank won't give you any money. And so getting into the water business has become a much more difficult proposition, and you see very, very few island boys headed that way. The last full large group of island boys to take up crabbing, they're now right at about 40 years old, so that tells you how long it's been. So what's happened is that kids, as they graduate from Tangier Combined School, which is the only K-12 left in Virginia, they leave the island for the military or for college, and they don't come back. And consequently, the island is aging rapidly. Its average age is in the mid-50s now, and there's a very large percentage of islanders who are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so a die-off is looming, and really has been underway for a while. And the population is nosediving. You know, you can chart Tangier's population over the years, and it grew to reach close to 1,300 people by the early 1930s. And then beginning with a transformative hurricane that hit the bay in 1933, the population starts to drop. And for the first 5 decades, it follows a pretty shallow glide slope as it drops. But then in the 80s, it starts to nose. And so in 2000, the island's population was 604. It now sits at 460, so it's lost a fifth of its population in 18 years. And it's going to get worse. And it'll get worse quickly, you know, the decrease in population will steepen. So that's an issue. Because you're on an island, and you know, if you're living in a small town in the Utah desert or in the American South, and the grocery store closes, well, it might be awfully inconvenient, but you get in your car and you drive 5 or 10 miles to the next town over, and you go to the grocery store there. But when you're on an island, 12 miles from the mainland, and the weather's bad, and your grocery store is no longer, and the island has just one, and it's small, you're in trouble. Suddenly, especially because you have an aging population that cannot get around as it once did, that becomes more than an inconvenience. That becomes an existential threat. Same goes for the school, which had 100 students in 2000, and which next year will be down to 53. There comes a tipping point where you lack the human critical mass to be affordable to the cash-strapped mainland school district that oversees you and finances you. And, if the school were to close, heaven forbid, a third of the island would leave instantly, because the alternative to having your kids in school at the K-12 on Tangier is to put them on a boat that would have to cross 16 open water miles of Tangier Sound and Pocomoke Sound, to often turbulent arms of the bay, to get to Anancock, the nearest Virginia town. That's a no-go for most Tangier parents. There's no way they put their kids on a school boat across that water. So you'd see them leave. And because most Tangier families are two-parent, you'd see a much greater effect from an exodus like that than you might on the mainland, where divorce is more common. So it's, and then finally, I guess the other critical service that faces a tipping point is the mailboat, which is actually a family business. It has the contract to carry the mail, but it is not a government undertaking. And again, you have to have a critical mass of passenger use to continue operation, to remain solvent. And I'm not sure where the tipping point is for each of these critical services, but it's looming for each. And that's scary.
This all illustrates vulnerabilities, right? Not only for Tangier, but for other similar communities, not only environmental vulnerabilities, but others that you've enumerated.
Yeah, it really does. And Tangier is a canary in the coal mine on several fronts. Most pressingly, of course, on the environmental, because the dilemma in which the island finds itself is going to play out in a neighborhood near yours, pretty doggone soon.
Yeah. I don't know, and we talked about this a little bit, it would maybe loop back around. I don't know how people on Tangier's, I imagine they maybe have mixed feelings about being a poster child case for climate change, for rising sea water.
Well, I think they have very mixed feelings about it. Of course, they'd rather not be in the situation they're in. They'd rather not have to be a poster child. I think they're grateful for the attention, because they hope that it'll bring some sort of government action to save them. But certainly, yeah, this is a place that's been populated for 240 years and has a lot of claims to fame. And I think it's frustrating to some islanders that what they're becoming best known for is the idea that they might not be there much longer. It's dispiriting. Yeah, I think it's it's probably a good thing that it's as faith-based a population as it is, because I think faith has become ever more important to just getting through the day.
You just joined us. We're talking with Earl Swift. His new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen, A Vanishing Tangier Island. So Earl Swift, you've mentioned a very religious community. Is, I don't know the proper word to use, this, do people on Tangiers consider this just to be a sign of end times? Is this inevitable act of God kind of a thing? How do they fold this into their religious beliefs?
Well, I think there is an element of that. I do think that some see this as a harbinger for the end times. I think that more of them, however, see themselves as an anointed people, that they've been anointed through their prayer and their staunch belief over time, and that they have been spared numerous times in the past because of their faith. And they'll cite as examples a cholera epidemic that could have taken down the island in the 19th century but did not, typhoid epidemic that could have done the same, multiple hurricanes beginning in 1821, where one that was rather modestly named the September Gust, apparently covered the island in 3 feet of water, the highest point of the island. They have come through battered but intact through all of these episodes, and that further it affirms their belief that they are anointed. And so I think that you see a certain fatalistic acknowledgement that the end may be coming, but you also see a belief that they will be snatched from the jaws of destruction. And I'm not sure which of those beliefs is more prevalent. I think it probably shifts from day to day, but both are noticeable.
Hmm. In the meantime, they can see the waters rising, right? They can see the erosion. They don't have to imagine this. I wonder how this translates, or what do you think people will take from the people who don't know the history of, or the maybe the possible future of Tangier Island. This could potentially play out along many of our coastal areas.
It sure could. And it's sneaky. You know, because it's a marsh island, it doesn't react to sea level rise like it might if you were living in a beachfront town, say. It's not a case of the water climbing higher up the shore in a way that you can measure day to day or year to year. What happens is that as water gets deeper in marsh, the marsh drowns and it turns to open water, and high and dry ground turns to marsh. So what you see on Tangier is a gradually opening. You see a solid marsh island becoming a loose macrame of land, just strands of marsh linked together. It's something that you might not notice if you're a waterman going out and fishing up your pots every day and then coming home and spending little time, you know, out there in the wetlands. But if you get up in a plane and you compare aerial photographs of Tangier's Marsh today versus Tangier's Marsh from when I was there in 2000, say, the difference is startling. It's completely ponded up. The rivulets, the guts, as they're called in the bay, that run through, the tidal guts that run through the marsh, are twice as wide as they were when I was on the island 18 years ago. It's turning to Swiss cheese. It's just disintegrating from the inside out, as well as losing shoreline around its edges. So it's a diabolical kind of effect that it has. You know, if you're on solid ground, if you're on rocky ground, you could see it actually climbing the shores. Here, the shores are so soft and low that that's really, you don't have a gauge, you don't have a yardstick to measure it by, except that the island is drowning.
I wonder, just have a couple minutes left, I wonder if you could, there's some very interesting people, of course, there on Tangier Island. You spent over a year with them and other reporting trips. A superlative, who stood out to you the most, or one or two people you tell us about?
Well, I have many favorites on the island, but one who immediately comes to mind is a guy named Leon McMahon, who is 87 years old and the oldest active waterman on the island. And Leon goes out and gets up at 2 o'clock every morning, is on the water by 3:30, and he spends the next 9 to 10 hours dragging a scrape across the mud along the Tangier shore, scooping peeler crabs up into his net, dumping them onto his boat, and then eventually those become the soft shell crabs savored by gourmands up and down the coast. And you see pictures of Leon in the 1970s, and he was a big burly guy with mutton chop sideburns. And at 87, he's somewhat diminished. He's quite a bit shorter than he used to be, but he still has arms like Popeye's. His forearms are just knots of cables of strength. I wouldn't take him on. He's an amazing person. And then you've got Carol Moore, who opens the book. Carol took on as a habit visiting this abandoned settlement, Canaan, where her forebears had lived for generations, probably about 20 years ago. And she did it first as kind of a seamanship exercise. She wanted to get better at handling her boat in all kinds of weather. And the run up to Canaan, which is across a mile of marsh from the town proper, was a good test of that. But after a while, she became entranced by the notion that, you know, Canaan was not only a monument to lives already lived, but that it whispered of things to come, that it was a lesson in the impermanence of all things. And she took the kind of melancholy pleasure, I think, out of going there every day. It grounded her. And I just found her to be very thoughtful. And I think that what she has to say about the island and her place in it and the place of both in time and the grand scheme of things, help make the book perhaps speak a little more broadly than it would if it were just a book about one little island and the 460 people living on it.
Well, very interesting book. It's out now. Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. The author, Earl Swift, has joined us for the hour today. Earl Swift, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.